Hello and welcome to Citizen Kane Minute, the show that examines the greatest film of all time, 5 minutes at a time. Proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network, I'm your host, Rob Kelly. And joining me to discuss minutes 50 to 55 of Citizen Kane is frequent Fire and Water Podcast Network guest and my pal, Terry O'Malley. Hi, Terry.
You don't happen to have a good cigar, do you, Rob?
Oh, are you sure you don't have a good cigar? I'm going to keep asking you that throughout the 5 minutes. Keep going. Are you sure you don't have a good cigar?
I saw this picture.
Well, thank you so much for being here, Terry.
I really appreciate it. This is a fun podcast to listen to and reflect on.
Thank you very much. I hope so. So, before we get to the minutes in question, as I said, it's minutes 50 through 55. Terry, I got to ask you the standard questions. When did you first see Citizen Kane?
I have been racking my brain since your first podcast on the show to try to figure that answer, and I cannot figure it out. It was probably in college or not long after, so we're talking the mid-1980s. But I had already had the movie spoiled for me. I already knew its reputation, and I knew about this stuff through comic books and comic strips, because we had a lot of collection of Peanuts cartoons when I was little.
Okay.
Fawcett editions.
Sure.
And there's a strip I read, one book I read over and over again. I read all of them over and over again. But one strip is Lucy walks in on Linus and asks what she's watching. He says, Citizen Kane. And she says, first time you've seen it? He says, yes. And then she says, Rosebud was the sled. Just walks out of the room. So I knew the punchline before I even knew the joke.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was we had many Doonesbury books as well. This is the early 70s, mid-70s. And one of the Sunday pages had a panel of a truck in the background. This story was, I think Mark was hitchhiking. But in the foreground was a little girl with a sled that said Rosebud on it.
Wow.
So I already had this idea of Rosebud and the sled. And then when I got into reading superhero comics, and I got the book Superman from the 30s to the 70s, one of the stories in that volume includes Superman meets Orson Welles.
Ah, yes.
So this is where I learned even more about Welles' reputation, especially with the War of the Worlds broadcast. So from that point on, I was very intrigued by the character, by the man, by that movie and that radio broadcast. And those have been things I've been following ever since. And even in a Hembeck comic not long after that, Orson Welles made an appearance in a Hembeck comic.
Oh, that's right. I have that one somewhere on one of my shelves. Yes, that's right. Orson Welles shows up.
Aren't you that fellow who made the movie Citizen Kane all those years ago? Yeah, and yeah, he came in on an Orson beam.
That's right. Classic Hembeck joke.
Yes, I love it. So I had all this stuff already. So it was one of those things, okay, I know I have to watch this movie. I know why I have to watch the movie. I know what I should be looking for in the movie. And in college, I started to strike into old classic movies. My sister had already been into it, but you know, my big sister, so you ignore your big sister does, and that was foolish. Hmm. But then I got into it, and then I started going to revival movie houses after college. We had some great things in the Boston area. The Brattle Theater, which is still there. The Somerville Theater would show old movies. So somewhere early on in that era, I saw Citizen Kane. I may have even rented the videotape. I don't know, but I know I have seen it. The thing, though, that's odd for me, Rob, at least I think you will find it odd, I am not a great rewatcher of things.
Okay.
I've seen a handful of things a handful of times, but I don't watch stuff over and over and over again. So it's too much to get through already.
Right.
So it's been quite a while since I've watched Citizen Kane from the beginning. So it was fun last week to sit down and watch Citizen Kane, especially with the first six or seven Citizen Kane Movie Minute podcasts fresh in my memory. Mm-hmm. And now I'm even finding things that you didn't talk about. You get a chance to talk about those early pictures in the early podcasts. And I'm finding clues that you'll get to talk about later on that I can't talk about in my 5 minutes. But it was just wonderful to see once again just how extraordinarily well made and put together the movie is.
Now, when you watched the movie over again, did you watch it with some of your family? Because I know that there are members of your family you have imparted some of your movie love onto.
Yeah, my wife and daughter wandered in and out as they could. But it's one of those things. I have to watch this movie. And this is my time to watch the movie. So you want to watch it with me, watch it with me. And it was like, okay, I'll be back in a little while kind of thing. So then once my wife came back in, she stayed and watched it to the end.
Ah, but there you go.
She's an excellent movie critic as well. She's another film buff. So it was one of those, oh, look at that. Look at this. Look at that. Oh, look at that. Oh, yeah. Oh, and notice this over there. Both of us are doing that. And so she helped me a lot with some of the notes I took for my 5 minutes.
It is amazing to me how many people that I've talked to so far, or this is episode 11. And I think out of the 11, I think I've had 9 people tell me that they watched it in college for the first time. And having gone to art school, I didn't have that experience. I didn't have a campus. You know, I didn't have that sort of larger world of college to embrace. And I, you know, I'm really starting to think I missed something because I really would have loved to have had like a repertory theater showing old movies. It seems like everybody watched old movies when they were in college. I didn't get to have that experience. I mean, I had videotapes at that point, but that's a little different. But man, every single person is like, oh, I saw it in college. I wish I'd seen it in college.
It was a good time back then, just before the rise. Well, my mother was a college professor.
Wow.
So even before home video became a thing, she would get catalogs from film distribution companies of movies you could rent. And these would be reels of
movies. Right, like prints, sure, yeah.
Yeah, so I would spend a lot of time just looking at the titles, looking at the images, the posters, having no idea what the movies were, who these actors were, who the directors were. And that just, you know, laid a really good foundation. So when I came across a title later on, I said, oh, I remember this. I remember reading this title before. This was a thing. And so, yeah, and in college, we did a play, one of a spring play called History of the American Film by Christopher Durang. And it's a spoof of Hollywood movies. The first act, this is a play, mind you. The first act is all in black and white.
Hmm.
So all the sets were painted gray. The food was painted gray. All the costumes were in black and white.
Nice. And
the closing first act finale is a big rousing number. We're going to war. And that's when the color starts to happen. So, but to prepare, we watched a lot of these old movies and had to do some research. And so that was the first time I saw My Man Godfrey. And it's like, okay, I'm all in now. This is wonderful.
And that's then a great movie.
Another course, I think I audited it, a film appreciation course. And that was the same thing, getting movies shown in, you know, the little screening room where you usually look at the art slides, but this is could look at movies instead on the big auditorium. So I might have seen Citizen Kane there, but again, I can't remember.
Hmm. That's amazing. That sounds like a marvelous experience. When I worked at the video store that I worked at, Movies Unlimited, I still say we, even though I haven't worked there in 20 years. But one of Movies Unlimited's big claim to fame was they would yearly put out this catalog of all their titles. And it was not phone book size, but pretty close.
Mm-hmm.
It was a giant, giant catalog. And I remember spending many an hour just reading it like it was a book. And I look back on it now, I'm like, what a nerd I was that I was sitting there. But I would sit there and just discover movies I'd never heard of.
Yeah,
you know, well, I was like, what's this? What is this thing? You know,
my wife and I have a similar thing. I met her in 1988, but someone had given her a gift because she was such a movie fan. Hallowell's Film Guide. Do you know
Hallowell? Yes, sure.
So they're like the 15th edition. So this is even before the film guides of things that were available in home video. So Hallowell has still actually, you know, in the room, but that was our resource before the internet. What else was he in? What other thing did he direct? Quick, get the Hallowell. I haven't seen this title. What's this story about? So that was a lot of fun to me. So I understand completely looking at titles.
Yeah, it seems like a weird way to spend your time, nevertheless. So now you said you don't watch a lot of movies repeatedly.
No.
So do you own a lot of movies? Because I would imagine you don't, probably not a need to if it's not something you do a lot.
There are a lot of movies in our collection. I mean, going back to VHS, stuff that, you know, I taped off the television, stuff that we saved in the DVR still downstairs. And I think part of the reason I don't rewatch a lot of things is there's always something else to watch. Mm-hmm. I like to share the experience. So it's, you know, I have a wife. Before that, it was my girlfriend. So it's, you know, let's watch a film together. Let's choose a film. And but since we become parents, it's let's teach this child which good movies she's going to watch. And we did. We curated her tastes. So she's mad. We just came back from a quick vacation in the Catskills. And so Claire brought some CDs. Yes, we still use physical media because it's reliable. And I said, choose, just bring some music along. We'll take turns, you know, choosing to listen to podcasts or listen to old radio programs or listen to music. And my daughter's first choice to listen, first selection on the music was the soundtrack to the Fred Astaire film. It's kind of right out of my head.
Top Hat, Swing Time.
It's an MGM from the Freed Unit, The Bandwagon.
Okay.
And then her second choice was the soundtrack to Singin' in the Rain.
Ah, okay.
And she listened to these repeatedly for at least 10 years.
Wow.
So that's her speed. She loves that stuff.
She's
an old soul, so she watches old movie musicals. She's quite knowledgeable about them. And she watches film noir on TCM every Sunday.
Eddie Muller, I'm sure, would be thrilled to know that. That's great. So, well, okay. So do you, it's maybe hard for you to judge this because you said you haven't seen the movie in a long time between just watching it last week and then first time, but like, do you think it deserves the title as the greatest film of all time?
I'm prepared for this. No, okay. I don't. And I get several reasons why. No, I don't. First of all, I'm in no position to judge because I haven't seen every movie ever made.
Well, well, then no one is, Terry. I mean, come on. Well,
that's part of the reason. I mean, there are so many great motion pictures. And now the definition of motion picture is really getting muddled in terms of what is a movie. Does a movie have to be a certain length? Does a movie, the Academy has always considered certain subjects not to be worthy of, you know, high esteem. And also, I really dislike the phrase of all time. Citizen Kane is not the greatest movie of the 1920s, and it's not going to be the greatest movie of the year 2525. So the greatest of anything of all time, I really dislike that. Mm-hmm. However, it is one of the most important Hollywood movies ever made. And I think there has to be a distinction of Hollywood movies because there are so many great German movies in the 1920s. The Russians, the stuff that they were doing in the 1920s, all those French and Italian films I haven't seen from the 1950s. I haven't seen the Japanese great films of the 1950s and 60s. So there's so many really great movies that have been made. And I've seen practically nothing of the last 30 years. So even I understand there have been a few good ones.
Yeah, there's been a couple, yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, but really things are, it really is, in terms of Hollywood, it's before Citizen Kane and after Citizen Kane. Because what Citizen Kane did was really bust the idea of the Hollywood factory, which is what it had been. The studio system and cranking the movies out and the star system and the director star system and the producer star system. And then Orson Welles was able to convince someone to give him money and carte blanche and do what the heck he wanted. And that really didn't happen. Well, it happened a little bit with Preston Sturges, but they shut him down pretty quick and they got how important he was. But it really didn't happen again until the late 60s when, you know, Orson Welles is, his real heirs took over and changed Hollywood forever. But up till then, no one had really done what he had done. People like Sturges came pretty close. People like Keaton. Chaplin was his own studio. He was still a studio. He just wasn't cranking out product constantly. But Orson Welles said, look what I can do almost all by myself if I hire the right people. And I don't need the studio boss to come in and mess things up. And of course, his second film was exactly what they did, right?
Yeah.
It's, yeah, you know that trick twice, Mr. Magician. We know what you're doing now.
Yep. We're gonna take it away from you, and we'll mangle it to our heart's content. Yeah, but
right back in the factory.
I do wonder sometimes if Citizen Kane would be considered quite as special if Welles's other films had not been almost every one of them post Kane mangled by somebody else. There's something so unique about Kane Stands Alone that it was never touched by the studio. It is the purest vision of Orson Welles and his crew than any other movie possibly, because every other movie has been somebody got their hands on it and messed with it.
Messed it up, right? That's a very good point.
Yeah. You know, it's funny you say about foreign films and not to get too far afield off of Citizen Kane, but you mentioned Russian films. And I have seen comparatively very few foreign films. And I've seen even less of Russian films. I just have not seen a lot of Russian films. But I remember many years ago, again, back when I worked at the video store, I had we had a coworker who loved Russian cinema. And he would find bootlegs and things. And he gave me a tape of this 1967 horror folktale called The Vij. It's spelled V-I-Y, but it's pronounced Vij, apparently. And it means spirit of evil. And it's this sort of horror Russian folktale. And it's 78 minutes long, made on a shoestring budget. But it is one of the most visually inventive movies I ever saw.
Mm.
And you can almost see that it was made for no money. But man, it had that spirit of Citizen Kane, because it was like you could just tell the people that made it. It was directed by two guys named Konstantin Yershov and Georgi Kropodyov. I hope I'm saying those right. But as I watch it, I was like, oh my God, these guys are in love with movie making. Because it's so inventive what they're doing. Like, hey, you got hands coming out of walls and like all these in-camera effects. And it really, it had that same spirit to me, of like, no pun intended, of like, yeah, these guys are just like, look what we can do. And look at this. It's just amazing.
Yeah, similar to what Welles is doing with RKO, all those filmmakers were, you know, doing movies that had to be approved by the state. I've seen a lot of animation from behind the Iron Curtain from the 70s and 80s. And it's fabulous stuff, but it's the same idea. They can realize their vision with so few, you know, so little money, so little time, but so much talent and inventiveness. And that suppression really so often can yield to great art.
Yep.
And able to, and even this was true in Hollywood, some of my favorite Hollywood movies. Yeah, it gets by the censor. But if you, the viewer, know the code, you can see just how filthy this movie is. Not just, but, you know, other movies.
Right.
What, you know, beyond innuendo, blatant symbolism, often in Hitchcock's case. But it's nothing that the censor can say that we can't do that.
Right.
So a movie like you're talking about, the Russians under the Soviets, they were able to get things that were officially approved and still be able to create art.
Remarkable. And like I said, it's funny. I do rewatch a lot of movies, but like you say, sometimes I feel weirdly guilty. Like I should be watching something new instead of watching Jaws for the 95th time. Maybe I should watch, you know, it's one of the movies in the 17 streaming channel queues that I have that I haven't worked my way through yet. But, you know, I put Jaws back on.
But do you get paralyzed with choice?
I do sometimes. Yeah. I do. Yeah. Sometimes it's just too much. Yeah.
Something I know. I don't, because you spend, you know, half an hour just, how about this one? How about this one? How about this one? What is on the next page? What's the next page? And you spend too much time looking at the menu, no time looking at the movie.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like that thing with like the dog where they, you know, like put three bowls of food in front of the dog and the dog starves to death because he can't decide which of the three to eat from. Yeah. I have spent time laying in bed trying to put a movie on and spending 20 minutes. And I'm like, what am I doing?
Yeah.
I ran across 17 things I would have killed for 20 years ago. And now I'm like, eh,
what am I in the mood for? I don't know.
I don't know what I'm in the mood for. So, all right. Well, okay. Terry, fair enough. You made your case that Citizen Kane is not necessarily the greatest film of all time. So, okay. So let's talk about these minutes. As I said, it's minutes 50 to 55. They're going to be entirely a flashback from Jed Leland telling us different things. It's going to start with Leland talking to Mr. Thompson, and as we mentioned earlier, begging for some cigars, and it's going to end with Leland talking about Susan. So right at the beginning of these 5 minutes, except where you've got Joseph Cotten talking to Mr. Thompson here, there's this wonderful overlapping dialogue where Mr. Thompson is trying to talk, and Jed is either not really caring what Thompson is saying, or because he's older now and he's just maybe not quite as sharp, he's interrupting Thompson, talking over him, kind of answering a question one question ago, stuff like that. And Citizen Kane wasn't the first film to do this, certainly. His Girl Friday had a lot of this kind of overlapping stuff, but it was still relatively new and it feels utterly real because that's how people talk. They talk over each other. They don't wait for the other person to finish everything they're saying. And then they talk and it has, it feels like something you'd see in a Robert Altman movie 30 years later where they're just kind of jumbling over each other. And it gives the whole thing such great verisimilitude.
And I contend this comes from the Mercury Theater radio background of all these actors. Friends, if you're listening, you've not listened to War of the Worlds, you should listen to it. But there are many sections in War of the Worlds where there's overlapping dialogue, people talking, background talking. You don't really hear what the words are that they're saying. It's just tone and inflection. And so both of these actors were probably very used to that. And we're going to see more of that in this 5 minutes, the radio technique.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, that's a great point that both of these guys were familiar with Welles, and certainly Joseph Cotten was. And we're probably, used to this kind of thing of like, and yeah, the War of the Worlds, again, that's another thing that gives it such great feeling of reality when you hear all these voices. And as you say, you can't even make some of it out. Yeah. You're not meant to. You're not meant to because you're hearing a room full of people arguing about, oh my God, Martians are landing. So again, this and they keep on this whole for this opening volley. They keep on Joseph Cotten. He's just talking throughout the whole thing. And
one shot for almost 2 full minutes.
Yep. And he has this great line about, I never met somebody who had so many opinions. Mm-hmm. And I thought, man, wait till you hit Twitter, Jed. I mean, wow. And again, it's the whole notion of that Kane, because of the luck of his birth and his wealth and his position, that he is getting to, inflict, that's probably maybe too strong a word, but he is getting to share all of his opinions with people. And in a lot of ways, people can't turn them off because he is so ever-present in American culture at the moment. And again, that's something we're dealing with nowadays where you feel like you can't turn it all off sometimes.
The media, they have the loudest voice.
Yeah. A lot of people, have a disproportionate megaphone because of their circumstances and stuff. And so then we see Jed, sort of nodding in his reverie. And then we do this flashback to Kane talking to his wife, Emily.
Before we go on to that wonderful bit, I want to talk about how Orson Welles, the director, sets up the scene. Not only is it just one take on Joseph Cotten, so Joseph Cotten's doing his lines, but the whole setup is so bizarre. I mean, there are two people in the background, and they're real because one of them moves. Leland leans forward to ask for the cigar, then sits back. And the person in the middle background also leans back.
Oh, do they? I never noticed that.
Since my 5 minutes, I'm looking at everything.
Okay, right.
Because I was trying to figure out, where are they? Because the ceiling does not make any sense to me. It's like a bomb hit the ceiling. It's all jagged edges because it might be a solarium. They're on the top floor of this hospital, and the windows have some sort of chain link.
Very grim. It's a very grim looking. Yeah.
Well, the windows are grim, but that if a bomb didn't hit it, then it's this wide open air, great place to sit and get some air and light. But it's so odd. Because it is so indistinct. It's just that there's a very firm wall on the viewer's right, but then it's sort of like just ephemeral at the top. And for a movie that is famous for its ceilings, this is a very indistinct ceiling. However, it does lead me into my hypothesis about Jed Leland, which I will share now.
lay it on me, Terry.
And it's not apparent yet within this 5 minutes, but it is at the end of the 5 minutes, after the next 5 minutes, or even next 10. But Leland has a white visor on, and he has a white belt, or like a rope belt, around his robe. You don't see it really until he gets up to walk away with the nurse at the end of his segment. But it's very bright white. So because Leland is so honest. He is the moral center of Cain's life. And once, you know, Cain rebuffs him, then Cain has no moral center. And so Jed was trying hard in the early days to keep Cain, or to get Cain back to where Leland thought he ought to be. And I think Wells is setting up, in the previous, the one I listened to, which is not the previous 5 minutes, but the one before that with Corey Musa, when Jed's talking to Mr. Bernstein while the girls are dancing and Cain is dancing with the girls, and Jed starts to express concern about what Cain is doing. So Jed stays the moral, he always is in the moral high ground. Jed does nothing wrong. And so I think this is sort of, in this scene, we're seeing him sort of like with a heavenly glow. So the white visor is sort of like a halo, and the open sky above him is, you know, letting the heavens in on him.
Huh. I had never considered that before. Also, and his mustache is now snow white as well.
That's true, yes.
But I'd never noticed that, Terry. I never really thought of it that way.
But you know, Wells is, as an image maker, is really very subtle, especially in this movie, especially with that snow globe. So there's a lot of little things. And, you know, as the viewer, there are many, many interpretations, of course. But, you know, everything is deliberate, which is exactly what we're going to talk about in the next bit.
Mm-hmm. That I had never considered that before. And it's, you know, it could be the kind of thing where you're feeling it in the back of your mind, but you're not consciously thinking it, but you're getting that read of it that, you know, Jed, as you say, he's the moral center of Cain's life. And even in this age, he's still the truth teller. Bernstein, right, as we established, still loves Cain, still worships him, has that giant, ridiculous painting of him in his office. Yeah. But Jed is still, you know, the guy who's going to give you kind of the closest to the true story of what really happened.
Rob, you just said truth teller. You just hit something that had been a conundrum for me. You're right. Bernstein is still the company man.
Yep.
I was wrestling with the next sequence that Jed is talking about. He's not in those scenes. It's just Cain and his wife. Now, on the one hand, I'm trusting Orson Welles, the storyteller, and Herman Mankiewicz, thank you very much, that this is accurate. But for Jed Leland to tell it, he must have heard the story from Charlie Cain.
Yep.
Or from Emily, because he already knew her before Cain did. So maybe they were still close enough that she could tell it, because this is certainly Emily's point of view, not Charlie's point of view.
Was it established that Jed knows Emily before
Cain? He met her at dancing school.
Oh, that's right. They do say that, don't they?
Yeah.
Interesting. Okay. All right.
Young Jed was a dancer.
Oh, that's right. Okay. Wow. Oh, wow. Wow. All right, Terry.
Told you.
I like this. I like where this is going.
This 5 minutes for every last flake of gold dust I can.
Wow. Okay. All right. Okay. I like the angelic Jed Leland. I like that idea a lot.
So for a while, I was thinking maybe he's an unreliable narrator, because he's still mad at Cain, so he's going to put Cain in a bad light. But you just said he's the truth teller. He's telling this. This is how it happened. He heard the story from Cain. He heard the story from Emily. He figured out what really happened.
It never would have occurred to me that this was potentially Emily telling Jed this. But mm-hmm. I can see it now. Now that you say it, I can see it. That maybe, or he heard part of it from Charlie, but he also heard the other part of it from Emily. He heard it was a he said, she said. And he heard it from both of them, and he sort of pieced it together himself.
And that's such a great little, that's almost a throwaway line. You didn't catch it. You've seen this movie 400 times.
Yeah.
And so yes. And that's of this script, and that's both Mank and Orson Welles. They're thinking everything through. If character A talks about character B, what is the relationship of character A to character B? How do they know each other? How does character A know character B's story? In those early scenes, when it's what's his name, the bank trustee guy, Thatcher.
Yeah, Thatcher.
His story, but the filmmaker gives us many more details that Thatcher wasn't consciously aware of.
Hmm.
but it's still accurate.
Yeah. All right. Very interesting. Okay. So we get into this flashback of Kane meeting or sitting down with Emily. And this is it's not the first appearance of Ruth Warwick, but this is really her first big scene. Again, because she played Emily. She lived until 2005. In many ways, she was basically the last major cast member of Citizen Kane to survive. She was in films like Journey into Fear, which is Orson Welles. She's she was in the infamous Disney film Song of the South. She was in Daisy Kenyon with Joan Crawford. But her fame was basically as a soap opera actress. She appeared in over 500 episodes of All My Children. And again, I've said this on 1,000 different podcasts at this point. If I was working with, Ruth Warwick while I was like putting on my eye patch, pretending to be somebody's evil twin, I would just be like, you were in Citizen Kane. You know what I mean? I'd just be like, she'd probably be like, leave me alone. Stop asking me about Citizen Kane. Cause she's probably, sick of it. But nevertheless, imagine sitting on a set and having lunch with someone in Citizen Kane.
Fabulous, isn't it? But she was a working actor.
Yeah. And
she tried to be a working actor for many years. You get a job, you keep the job.
Yep.
You get a job, like that, you get a contract, buy a house. You stay in a house instead of if you're on the road, going from town to town like in the old days. So good on her.
Yeah. Kept working forever. Good. Yeah. Great for working well into her 80s. Great for her. So
you were asking earlier guests about, expressing surprise that so few of these actors in this movie did not go on to great film movies. And I think it's because they were Mercury Theater people. They were not RKO people. RKO, I wanted nothing to do with them. They could help it.
Yep. So we see them, Kane and Emily, and the sort of the mutual falling in love. We see all the bric-a-brac. This is a very ornately designed living room. We actually see some things that we will – there's like a sort of big statue kind of cup vase sort of thing in the background. We'll see that later on in Xanadu. And, right at the beginning, of course, like in the beginning of the relationship, they have the mutual irresistibles for each other. Mm-hmm. And Emily is sitting on the side, and they are catty-cornered to one another. Wells looks quite dashing, or Kane looks quite dashing with his mustache and his kind of like flyaway hair a little bit. And there's that innuendo you even talked about where he talks about how they're going to spend their evening. And Emily's like, it's late. And Kane's like, it's early, ... So we all know what that means, everybody. And they are just absolutely enraptured with one another, and they are sitting as close to each other as they can. And that is going to lead into one of the most famous sequences of this entire movie, where it is going to telescope an entire relationship in about four scenes.
Excellent.
It's just unreal how much is accomplished with so little. And the next time we see them talking, and they're starting to, bicker a little bit. We see that Emily is talking about why is Charlie spending so much time at the paper, and we can't help but notice that she is no longer sitting catty corner to him. She is at the end of the table, and he is at the end of the table. And they all of a sudden they're not in a two shot anymore. They're in a series of single shots, and he looks great with his robe, this sort of pleated vest kind of thing, and he looks even more dashing as he's lighting his pipe. But we see that the seeds of the problem is that she's complaining that she wishes she had a rival for his affections of flesh and blood instead of printer's ink, and he sort of dismisses her a little. It's sort of like, well, you married a newspaper man, what are you going to do?
Now, I just want to just back up a little bit. These are all breakfast scenes.
That's right.
Because that's what Jed says. They only saw each other at breakfast. So the first one is they've been out all night. They've been to six parties. They're still in their evening clothes. And he is serving her. So he has made breakfast. He's made eggs and bacon. There's a bottle of ketchup on the table and maybe some Worcestershire sauce. Just toast and bacon. And they get that look in their eyes. He's not going in to work right away. So he's still in his evening tux, and she's still in her evening gown with an exposed neck. Her shoulders are exposed. Her hair is up. Double strand of pearls on. And the next time, the next one, it's a breakfast again. Again, her throat is open, and she's had a flouncy morning. It's not really a robe. It's like almost like a really nice nightgown. But as you said, he's in this gorgeous velvet robe, his dressing gown with the quilted lapels and the quilted.
Oh, man, it looks marvelous.
It may be a pajama top. But the thing about, and then the next one, his robe is not as nice. It's still nice. It's probably silk, but it's much less ornate. And he's not wearing a shirt. So he's just rolled out of bed. But she is fully dressed in the third shot. Her throat is covered. She's got layers on, pleated lapels. So there are more layers way out past her shoulders. And there's much less white. In the first shot, she was wearing a white gown. And now she's barely wearing any white at all. And the hair is a little lower. She had a little wave over her left eye as she starts to the more complaints. So each, I'm analyzing this inch by inch within each frame. So not only are their costumes changing, the background behind Emily is changing, but not behind Charlie. Behind Emily, there's a buffet. Then there's a different buffet later on. There's a coffee urn, and then there's some candelabras. So the furniture is changing as the years go by. New pieces keep coming in. But behind Kane, there is this Buddha-like statue. I don't know if it's a real Buddha, and I hope someone out there does. I tried to do an image search on it, and I couldn't find definitive. But it looks like it's very similar to a Buddha with the right hand raised, which is called a teaching or discussion mudra, with the right hand raised. Although it doesn't look quite the same as the image I found of the teaching Buddha, the learning Buddha, because it's hard to see in the movie, but it looks like different fingers are raised. So I'd really love to know what that is, because it is present in every shot of Charlie Kane at this sequence.
I don't think I've ever noticed that the background behind him never changes. I know hers does, but I don't think I've ever really realized it now that I'm looking at it, that yeah, the wall behind her has always got different things, but he's got these overgrown plants and the Buddha and stuff. And you notice too, in that third sequence, he's like kind of scowling at her. The first two, he's looking, the first one, he's looking her adoringly.
Oh, they're enamored. Yeah.
Yeah. The second one, he's kind of playing with her a little. He's trying to be kind of rakish. Like, well, I have to go to the paper, you know, I gotta be. And now the third one, we cut to him and he's sort of scowling at her. His brow is furrowed. And we're already telling, okay, the warmth has kind of died down a bit.
And now the next one is the worst. Well, not the worst. Really, the change in tone.
Yeah. And by the way, apparently the way Wells and his crew did this is they reversed it. That they started the end. They started with the end scene with them all looking older, and then slowly took makeup off to make them look younger, because of course that's the age they were when they started it, which was the initial sequence. So then, yeah, we cut to Emily, and she's looking even more ornate. She's got like what looks like a little doily like attached to her neck. It's more and more kind of complicated and sort of a cumbersome. She's got this candelabra behind him.
Look at those candles. My wife suggests this, probably wedding present, the candelabras.
Okay.
The throat is covered up. Now it's off-white, maybe an ivory color. Every sequence in this is less than 3 minutes. Ruth had to have her hair done differently each
six
time.
Six times, yeah.
Yeah, that is something.
Yeah, and we cut back to Charlie, and he is in an all-dark suit, and he's sort of fussily cutting whatever his breakfast food is, and he looks absolutely sort of just tight. His body language is all different. His shoulders are kind of hunched. Yes. He looks kind of pinched in, and it gives you, you know, it reminds one of the scenes you heard, like, if you've ever seen the Oliver Stone movie Nixon, where they sort of homage that, where all these different dinner scenes between Nixon and Pat, to where apparently legendarily at one point, Pat Nixon sat down to breakfast to dinner, and her husband said, "Nice to see you." You know, like he's talking to like a business associate. And it's like, you could see here, you get the sense he's barely even sort of acknowledging her that she's there, because he looks so annoyed.
Well, you're right. It is business, because the first three times we see Charlie, even though, you know, the first time his attire is evening suit, it's full evening suit, but he's sitting right next to her and facing her. But the second two, he's sort of, his feet are not under the table. He's sort of leaning against the table. But this time he is tucked in under the table. He is sitting up. He's got that full black suit, three-piece suit. Tie is already tied. Hair is combed. He is going to the office in 14 seconds flat. The chauffeur is already waiting for him. He's not going to, previously, he was in his robe. He's going upstairs to get dressed and go to the office. Now, well, he's dressed. He's ready to go. Emily, we're not talking about this. We're talking business. Mr. Bernstein may come to the nursery sometime.
That's right. And then they have the conversation about the president. She's very critical of that because he's very critical of who he refers to as a still a fathead.
Well, that was the previous scene. So he was still, he went from joking to, is he joking? That mean kind of joke. When you say teasing her about Uncle John. Mm-hmm. And we'll change that someday. And that's real acid in that humor. But in this one, when he's got the three-piece suit, she says something about Mr. Bernstein sending, I didn't write down the adjective she used about the gift. It was worse than inappropriate. But what the heck could Bernstein could have sent? Unless it was something that she thought was, quote, too Jewish, close quotes, and showing her anti-Semitic side.
Oh, what that never, that's brand new to me, Terry.
Credit my wife for that idea.
Okay.
I mean, why? What could you send to a nursery that would be objectionable?
I take it as he sent something ornate and fancy designed to impress Charlie, but not appropriate for a child.
Maybe, yeah, but I mean, it seems like the whole house is like that.
Well, right, yeah. I mean, the house is full of this stuff. And then we cut back to her again. She's looking even more formal, and this is where she says, people will think, and he cuts her off, and we cut back, and he is looking, he's got a bow tie, and his face looks taut, and he barks at her, and he goes, what I tell them to think, and he kind of drops the teacup down, and that's the whole scene, is that little exchange, where that's where they are now, where she can't even get out a thought without him just sort of cutting her off as if he's just no longer interested in talking to her at all.
The thing I like about what her outfit is, now she's wearing something much more loose fitting. It's an almost sheer blouse. I couldn't quite see where the blouse, because of it's the black and white film, where the blouse was and what was, if her sternum was exposed. I don't think so. Couldn't have been. But her throat was exposed. It's very fancy and frilly. So I was wondering if this was, one more try for intimacy. She's trying to look nice at breakfast for him. And he just cuts her dead.
Huh.
And the candelabras are now separated on a brand new buffet.
So you're shaming me here, Terry. So then we do the final reveal, and there's no dialogue at all. And yes. we see Emily, and it's the kicker of the scene where she is reading the paper. And, of course, she is no longer reading the Inquirer. She's reading the rival paper. She's reading the Chronicle. And she just gives him an icy stare, cuts over to Charlie Kane. We see the Buddha once again, and it's completely covered over in vines, and he is reading the Inquirer, and we get this slow pan out, and we see that the table now is, they are as far away from each other as they possibly can, and they're not even talking. And it is scenes from a marriage done in 3 minutes.
And she's back to being fully covered up in some sort of satin material. Her throat's covered again. Her hair is covering her ears. Very short, square-cut lapels, plus, it's very, what did I write? Something on her sternum. So she is now covered up. Forget it, Charlie. You're not getting close again.
Yep.
Another new buffet.
It's just an extraordinary, extraordinary sequence of just presenting everything you need to know about a marriage so briefly and with relatively little dialogue. I mean, a lot of work, a lot of sets, but just boom, 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 six transitions, done. You get the entire story of their marriage told.
Yeah, now that dialogue, even though it's so short, if you just listened to the dialogue with the musical cues, you get the same effect. You would understand the relationship these two have. And that goes back to the radio, because that's how you do the transition with a little quick music sting. So the instrumentation is going to mean something, whether it's a major key or a minor key. All that plays on the ear, which plays on your sense of understanding. And Wells knew that as well as anybody in the medium back then. But he understands this is a different medium. He can use that trick up to a point, but then he has a brand new trick and no dialogue. What you cannot do with radio is show something, and you show this without telling. And you're absolutely right. It explains their whole relationship, what's going on and what's going to happen.
It's just marvelous. And it's a reason why it's one of the most famous scenes in a movie full of famous scenes. So then after that, we cut back to Jed, and he's continuing to talk to Mr. Thompson, and he sort of sums up about their whole relationship and, sort of rueful about Charlie Kane. And then he moves on to start talking about Charlie Kane's next wife, Susan. He moves on to what the problems are going to be with Susie, as he calls her, which again, underscores a sort of affection that he has for her, which we'll see later on. And that's basically how the 5 minutes wraps up, is Leland continuing to just talk.
I know, it just gets better and better. But is it affection for Susie? Because he didn't have much respect for her, certainly as an actor.
Leland certainly understands that she was manipulated and bossed around by his friend. I think I always took it as that he sort of liked her as a person, not a right fit for the wife of Charles Foster Kane, but I always took it that he liked her as a person in some way.
And that's why this movie is so rich. And this is sort of why I haven't watched many movies in recent decades, is my aesthetic is still stuck way back then. And what Wells does here, and what a lot of great directors do, is you let the actors act. You don't just take the best take of each line and paste it together. Last night, I saw maybe 20 seconds of a movie that's about 30 years old, a very famous, awful movie. But it was like, shot of character A, reverse shot of character B running, back to shot of character A, shot of character C, reverse shot of character A, then shot of character C. And it was the 10-second scene. We have 15 shots. Frame it. Let the actors do something so we can see the relationship of these people to each other.
Yeah, it's all cutting nowadays. It's all cutting.
And I can't take it. And so when we're flicking through stuff, seeing what's on, yeah, I see stuff like that, 2-3 cuts. I'm done. I'm not interested. Just director.
Well, I mean, Terry, we're wrapping up here. Is there anything else you want to say about either the movie or these 5 minutes?
Yeah, I just want to ask you, you absolutely sure you haven't got a cigar?
I'll ask him about a cigar. I love that he's such a one-track mind on that. Like, he just wants some nice cigars. He's so charming.
Gift shop. He is charming. He's wonderful.
Well, Terry, again, thank you so much for coming by and talking Citizen Kane with me. We've done a bunch of podcasts together, and it's always a delight to talk to you. So thank you so much.
Absolute pleasure, Rob. Thank you so much.
Why don't you tell people where they can find you out on the internet?
I lurk on the Fire and Water sites, and I'm not commenting nearly enough. I write comments in my head. I don't get them over to the computer fast enough. And I'm on Twitter and Facebook, and I play in a rock and roll band, friends. So if you like the good old-fashioned rock and roll music, go look for Stop Calling Me Frank on all your favorite music streaming channels and on Rumbar Records, and our new single is coming out in September. Be sure you get a copy of that.
All right, very cool. Again, thank you so much for stopping by. I really do appreciate it. Of course, everybody, you can find the back episodes of this show on our website, fireandwaterpodcast.com. You can subscribe to Citizen Kane Minute on any of the podcatchers of your choice. We're always talking Citizen Kane over on Twitter at CKane Minute. And finally, if you want to support the Fire and Water Podcast Network, just go to patreon.com/FW Podcast, and there you can unlock various rewards, one of which is to be name checked on a show of your choice. So big thanks to Slick, who is a Patreon supporter of Citizen Kane Minute. I very much appreciate it. So that's going to do it, everybody. Thanks for listening. Come back next week for more Citizen Kane Minute.
What's the real truth about Charles Foster Kane? I wish you'd come to this theater when Citizen Kane plays here and decide for yourself.